All right, that was Muse with Uprising from their CD Resistance. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Now, we got a very special show for you today. Looking at the world over these last few years, including what's happening right here inside this country, I've been more than a little concerned. You know, sometimes you get up, you walk through the world, and you start to feel like you're living in the middle of Orwell's 1984. War is peace, repression is freedom, and on and on and on. And most troubling of all is the relative quiet we're in the face of all this. So I decided to run two interviews I did in the past. The first is from a few months ago, and it's with Andy Z from Revolution Books in New York City, and the author of the article, The Collapse of the Movement, The Resistance and the Revolutionary Movement We Need. You can find this article on revcom.us, and I encourage everyone who gives a damn about humanity to check it out. The second interview is an excerpt from one I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a number of years ago. It was a wide-ranging and fascinating discussion, and in this excerpt, we focus on the question of, is it absolutely nuts to think that you can wage and win a popular revolution in this kind of country? So let's kick things off with Andy Z. And I'm just going to read the beginning of this, and then we'll jump into this. The beginning of this article is really worth listening to and thinking about. A grievous, shameful, and dangerous state of affairs permeates the movements of opposition in the U.S. Their outlook and politics have collapsed into passive acquiescence and even overt criminal complicity with the policies and actions of the ruling class, and are doing so by promoting the deadly illusion that the election of Barack Obama is bringing progressive change. This is bull. It's knowable, and it must change. That's from Andy Z's article, The Collapse of the Movement, The Resistance, and the Revolutionary Movement We Need. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
What is it that forms the foundation for this article, a need for this article? What is it that actually made you want to write this article?
Well, I think if we've looked out over the whole last period of time, a trajectory really going from 2004 to now, but particularly in the last year, the resistance movement has gone to lower and lower levels of resistance, of masses of people in the street, to the point now where we have these revelations around torture, and this is being done and continues to be done in the name of people in this country, and there's a little noise in the media about it and on the internet, but there's not the kind of protest and condemnation that needs to be going on. So that was the genesis of it.
I was looking at some of the things that are being said about torture. When they wrote the Military Commissions Act?
Mm-hmm.
When they passed that, and there was this whole idea that somehow under the Bush regime that torture was okay. And then you have this thing now where there's all these memos that are coming out that are just really disgusting. I mean, somebody had mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago, look, do you realize that they waterboarded people over 200 times, you know, almost 300 times? They had the one guy that they did 183 times, another guy that did 90 times, you know, and you're thinking about this. And not only is there not the uproar that you would think that would just basic decent humanity just on that level would require, but there's also this thing of, you know, somehow then the discussion becomes, you know, it goes into the ticking time bomb scenario, but it also, they start citing Jack Bauer in 24 and saying, but this is it. Is the information going to be useful or not? And to think that these kinds of things are what the parameters of discussion today of whether or not you're going to oppose something as criminal, as much of a war crime as torture, is just, it's insane.
Yeah, well, these are the terms. In fact, there's a lengthy article by Mark Danner in New York Review of Books. There's a lot to learn from this article, but still the terms are being set on did they get actionable evidence from people on account of torture or not. And that is completely in the wrong ballpark to be looking at this, and it's part of what actually contributes to the passivity of people, because that's not actually the question. To tell you the truth, we're learning a lot now, most of what we know has actually been pretty much out there since 2004. In fact, I was involved in doing something in New York, the Bush Crimes Commission, where we actually did a mock tribunal on the Bush regime, including on the question of torture. And a lot of the evidence that's coming out now, we were able to amass in some initial ways back then. And at this commission, Craig Murray, who had been a former ambassador from Great Britain to Uzbekistan, made a very important comment, more than a comment, actually a stand that we all can learn from, where he said, I would rather die than have my life saved on account of somebody else being tortured. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important stand for people broadly to take.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we need to go deeper and look at, well, what is the role of the U.S. and why does it torture?
And at the same time, the war has disappeared from the dialogue.
The war has disappeared, except for, you know, some articles here and there, but the war has pretty much disappeared. And
well, I mean, I think in terms of this question of language, this has been a rebranding of the essentially the same overall policy. Even the New York Times ran an article, which we quote in this piece, that talked about this. In fact, they quoted Bush's National Security Advisor, Gordon Jandro, who said that he, quote, detected a great deal of overlap in actual policy between the two presidents. And certainly on the front of national security policy, including the torture, the spying without a warrant and all of this, that this has essentially been left intact by Obama, but yet he's gotten rid of the term enemy combatant, but the actual reality of it still exists, the ability of the executive branch and to detain anyone without cause and in secret and indefinitely. There is a question of people confronting the reality of what is continuing, and as well as looking at what has changed, hasn't in that sense, and more importantly, how an entire movement over a period of several years has been demobilized from acting in the interests of people of the world and opposing what our government is doing.
Let's get into that, because I think I'm sure that there are people sitting out there whose hackles were just raised by the idea that we could be talking about the collapse of the movement. That's a fairly strong statement. I mean, you talk about collapse and actually talk about complicity, criminal complicity. And if you're going to say that, then let's explain why.
Even just take the question of torture, and we just can't reduce it to torture, but if you just take the question of torture without bringing indictment, without prosecuting the war criminals all the way up, then what are you actually saying? You're saying this is okay, this is fine, and what reason would you have for thinking it's fine or okay? Only that you feel you might face this necessity to do it again. And certainly the question of torture has been with us for a long time. Look, waterboarding goes back to the Spanish Inquisition, if not before, but it's a tremendous American tradition. You have President Taft, who before he was president, was governor of the Philippines at the turn of the last century, and he actually presided over water torture that was used. It was so frequent during the Spanish-American War in the Philippines that the military even marched to a little ditty that sang this song. So this is the kind of thing where we're talking about, where you're going from passive acquiescence of not getting out and doing the kind of protest that was going to be required to really stop the direction of the Bush regime, to a more active complicity, where you're actually out there telling people that some good things can happen from this regime.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Andy Z about the collapse of the movement, the resistance, and the revolutionary movement we need. Now, Andy, coming off that last point,
some people would say, well, look, it's not that the movement has collapsed. It's changed its character. Its open features have changed, because right now you have someone who will listen to you in the White House. You have someone who, I've even heard people say the most disturbing stuff about, he's one of us, you know, in terms of he's come out of the movement, and you can actually influence him. And they go from things like, the important thing is the movement that he's called forth, that Obama has called forth, that the election Obama has called forth, that movement can actually give Obama a basis to do things that he might not be able to do otherwise, or that the job of the movement is to give Obama a hot foot, to hold his feet to the fire, forcing him to somehow do the right thing.
Yeah, well, look, there's two basic assumptions there. One is that this system isn't a system, that we don't live under a system, that there isn't a nature to imperialism, that there isn't a reason why the U.S. went into the Mideast, and that this was just some incidental things, that aberrations that occurred under Bush and aren't actually part of a whole way that imperialism works. And we should get into what that's actually meant to people and what it continues to mean. And then there's a belief that you can actually make this thing work for you. We can work for us. That the very system that oppresses people here and around the world can actually be used to the advantage of the oppressed. And this is an illusion which, you know, we need to actually talk about and get into. But we should start from what he's actually done. He brought 21,000 more troops into Afghanistan, and they've held out the option of bringing even more in. The political alliances they're making in Afghanistan and the rest of their program has included instituting Sharia law in part of Afghanistan. He's expanded the war into Afghanistan with troops and unmanned drones. He's extended the deadline for withdrawing troops from Iraq to 2010, and he's held out that, depending on the advice of the generals, it could go longer. And even this withdrawal leaves 35,000 to 50,000 troops to defend what is the largest embassy ever built in world history in Baghdad, plus another 50 to 100,000 mercenaries. So this is what he's even talking about in terms of the ending the war, close to possibly 150,000 people staying there to continue to reinforce U.S. Rule there. He said he'd close Guantanamo in a year, and yet he also decided to and approved the budget to double the size of Bagram prison in Afghanistan. And he's defended the Bush policy of illegal warrantless wiretapping, and he's even asserted far broader claims of executive branch immunity. And as I said earlier, there's no motion actually right now to actually prosecute the Bush regime for their torture and war crimes, which, by the way, does make it his war crime.
Well, here's the question, though. I mean, when you're saying all these things that he's done, so how do you take on this thing, though, if people continuously, it's like the blinders go down and there's no talking to people who then say, well, really, what we have to do is pressure him. We have to bring the match closer to his feet because his feet aren't getting hot enough. This isn't just a question of whether or not he's betrayed his campaign promises or he's not doing what we want him to do. You know, there is a system that's operating here. Why don't you get into that about what is actually at the root of this? Because why would you argue against this idea of holding his feet to the fire as what the movement should be doing? Andy, what about this? What is the situation here? I mean, is it just that people are not doing enough of his holding his feet to the fire, putting enough pressure on him?
Well, look, people should be out protesting. The point is not that there's not a need for resistance. There's an incredible need for resistance on many different levels. People should be out in the streets, but the question is out to do what and in what interests. And are people thinking that in terms of this hold his feet to the fire, there is no fire there if you're actually not largely fighting and directing your protests in the interests of the people of the world. And look, one of the big problems here, and one of the main reasons people aren't out there, is an entire movement has turned its attention away from the crimes that their own government is committing to what their system is actually doing to people here and around the world, and instead refashioning things in terms of what's in the interest of the American people, and looking at that a lot backward through the lens of the 1930s and saying, well, we need a big movement to stave off the effects of the economic crisis on people here. And not actually looking at that this is a system that's going on here. This is not new. And I think this is what what the article is saying, just holding his feet to the fire. Let's talk about fighting in the interests of the people of the world. Let's start thinking about that. Let's put an end to the torture. What about the fact that this war is still going on? What about the drones that are in Pakistan? What good do you think that's going to do for humanity? And putting out an illusion here that Barack Obama is for you and somehow can serve the interests of the people is extremely poisonous. He's not president of the People's Republic of the U.S. He's president of U.S. imperialism. That's his job description. And he's actually quite open about it. He's been open about it all through his campaign. His job is to rescue this system.
You know, this isn't just something that spontaneously happens among people. There is an element of people, you know, this delusion and illusion and deceit and self-deceit. But there's also, there is a point, there have been programs, there have been positions put out that actually take people and say that, look, America can be made to work. America can be made to do good in the world. America can be made to work. America can be made to serve the interests of the people here. And even to a certain extent, I think you get into in the article, the idea that someone would actually start talking about that the problem with the war in Afghanistan is that Obama's strategy is not going to bring victory. These are the kinds of things, the parameters that are being set out, that there's somehow America can work good in the world.
There's an old joke from the Lone Ranger series, which was a television show in the 50s and early 60s, of the Lone Ranger, the white cowboy on his white horse with his Native American sidekick, as it was. And at a certain point, one of these episodes, they're surrounded by a number of other Native Americans, although that wasn't the word they used at that time. And Tonto the Indian, as he was called, was on his horse, and Lone Ranger was on his, and the Lone Ranger turned to Tonto, and he says, what are we going to do? And he says, we who, white man? And this is the question of, are you going to identify with a system that does carry out torture, that does, its whole history is one of invasion? I mean, the Revolution newspaper put out a challenge. It said, spin a globe. Pick any country in the third world and find a 10-year period where the U.S. hasn't either been at war, launching a coup, launching an assassination, or in some way attempting to dominate the rest of the world and bring tremendous oppression to the people. This is not incidental. And there has been a movement that is, it continues to exist, that's peddling illusions. And the article begins by talking about United for Peace and Justice refusing and voting to not demonstrate on the sixth anniversary of the war, instead putting forward a slogan Beyond war, a new economy is possible. Yes, we can. I mean, you know, as I wrote here, it's hard to tell what's worse in that slogan, the lie or the chauvinism. So we should, you know, we should talk about this some more and get into it. Is that going to actually lead to anything good in the world? Or is it going to lead to people having illusions about what, in fact, is happening and why, in fact, Obama's even president, for that matter?
Mm-hmm. Take a minute to think about that while I remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Andy Zee from Revolution Books in New York City about an article he wrote calling out the collapse of a meaningful opposition movement in this country and the resistance and revolutionary movement that we need.
There is this whole point that's become a big point, and it's something that it's interesting the way it gets raised because it comes into the whole period where in the 30s when they talked about what saved America, the New Deal, and now this is being thrown out again in one way or another, politically and socially and economically, as sort of this is the path that Obama's going to take to actually save America. What about the New Deal, man?
First off, why would you want to save America? That's one question that has to be asked of an opposition movement in the country that's at the top of the imperialist food chain. And if you want to know the real fruits of the New Deal, it was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then an unending period of wars, of aggression and counter-revolution and establishing neo-colonies and overthrowing national liberation struggles. This is what it actually meant. And if you get into the New Deal, look, heroic struggle was, determined struggle was waged in the 1930s. People fought, people died fighting against the effects of the Great Depression, and that's an important struggle. But it was led after 1934 in the direction of supporting and in the framework of supporting the extension of democracy in this country and around the world, and it left people politically and ideologically in a position where they ended up fighting and being disarmed ideologically in terms of fighting the interests of the U.S. It even got to the point where the Communist Party was saying that communism is 20th century Americanism. And of course, you leave people ideologically unprepared, and then in fact, they get hit at the end of World War II with McCarthyism, and they're completely incapable of dealing with that. And so this is where this can lead and where it is leading. That's the problem. It's where it is leading. How do we actually repair U.S. imperialism? That is the question.
I want to have you speak a little bit to this point you raised towards the end of the article, but the fact is there will be no anti-war movement worth the name or a movement against anything else of consequence if it is not struggling fundamentally outside of and in opposition to the framework of the system that's at the root of and carrying out the wars and other forms of oppression. Because I think that's related to what you're talking to.
I think that's very important. And that's actually a point that's gone into in some depth in a pamphlet called Making Revolution, Emancipating Humanity by Bob Avakian, who's chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. But it's a very important point because, look, the overall framework for how you have to look at this question of what the U.S. is doing in the world and what Obama himself is continuing in terms of the policies of the Bush regime is that we have to stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about the interests of humanity. This is fundamental when you live in a country like this. The rubric under which the Bush regime, Bush and Cheney, carried out their whole program was the War on Terror, which was actually and has proven itself to be a war of terror on the masses of people for U.S. empire. This is really essential, and there's nothing that Obama has said, and there's nothing he's done, which gets you outside of that kind of framework for what the U.S. is doing. There have been some changes. The Bush regime ran into a lot of problems in the world, and they needed to make some, the ruling class as a whole felt they needed to make some big changes, and Obama was it. But he is rebranding the same essential policies. Even as there are some changes that are being made, it's largely a matter of rebranding and going forward with a certain U.S. interest. And for all the talk of empire that kind of went on in this country in the 90s and the anti-globalization movement and then in relationship to the Bush regime, for all people's critique of empire, they tend to not understand that empire is actually a system. It's an imperialist system. It's not incidental. It's not off to the side in aberration. The Bush regime was an extreme concentration of a program of empire and imperialism, but it actually was a continuation of it, and this is systemic. And the only promise of America, as we put it in this article, is a promise of more invasions, more coups, and continued immiseration of the masses of people. And this is systemic. You know, we can go on. We should talk about it even in relation to the economic crisis. This is something that originates here in terms of the parasitic way that capitalism has become more involved in finance. And the effect of it, there's now over a billion people who are starving in the world. And the rates of starvation and absolute hunger are increasing daily in the world as a result of this economic crisis. Where is that being talked about in terms of when people say what we need is a new deal? Where are those interests in the movement? And this has a real consequence. My last point would be, you know, recruitment is up the U.S. Army right now. And while in part there's economic factors that lead to that, there's also the fact that there's a lot of black and Latino youth who now feel like, well, I wouldn't fight for the U.S., but I will fight for Obama. And there's the movements of resistance are not actually exposing to people what is the nature of fighting for Obama when he's head of the U.S. imperialist empire.
Exactly.
It is nothing other than enforcing these relations, enforcing this system all around the world.
Okay. We have to stop right there, Andy.
Okay.
We have to stop right there. I want to thank you very much.
Okay.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Andy Z from Revolution Books in New York City about the collapse of a movement of opposition in this country and the resistance and revolutionary movement we need. We're going to take a short break and be right back with a very special segment, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation. One of the main questions that I get from people all the time is, it has to do with the way I point out at the end of the show and really throughout the entire show, that if you spin the globe, if you take a look at the world any place, you can really see that it cries out for revolutionary change. And people come up and they ask me, okay, you say that, but do you really think that it's possible to do that here? Well, I had the opportunity a number of years ago to interview Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So I posed this question to him. So you think you can have a popular revolution here? Are you nuts? Let's take a listen to his response.
Well, and recently I had the experience of actually watching the film of your speech last year with a number of people, sometimes with them, sometimes after they've seen it. And there's been a couple of fairly sharp questions that came up that I wanted to raise with you. One of them was, a person saw it and said, that, and this is somebody, most of these people are from the middle strata, and this person in particular said that as he watched it, he kept thinking, this man is talking about a popular revolution. He's talking about a revolution that depends on people, the basic people in the streets, that depends on people in the middle class, it depends on the basic populace taking up this revolutionary ideology, taking up these revolutionary thoughts, or even taking up you know, a position or things that would allow them to move into action against the system. And he was saying that the problem he finds with that is that, for the most part, when he looks out at people, and in particular when he looks out at the basic population, but even the middle class, he finds people living a lifestyle that's sort of, as he put it, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's bling-bling, that's, you know, we get paid, we get the whatever. And that the problem is not that just that they're doing that, and that you would have some sort of, you know, even if he reduced it kind of crudely, he said, look, you know, even if you were able to go out there and wage a struggle around public opinion with these people, that they're living in a country inside a monster that has the biggest public opinion making machinery ever in the history of humanity. It has this huge, everywhere, from the moment you wake up, you know, you open your eyes, you're driving down the street, you can't look at a billboard, you can't, you know, there's nothing. It's just constant at you. And it reinforces all this backwardness and all this sort of self-serving kind of stuff among people. And that people, how could you actually ever get into, you know, get that population into a revolutionary mode?
Well, I mean, there, on the one hand, there is truth. They do have a very powerful, besides a very powerful military and a powerful economic base that underlies that, which is, once again, grounded in just brutal exploitation around the world as well as here. But they do have a powerful economy, they have a powerful military, and they do have a powerful a machine for molding public opinion, for influencing popular culture, you know, shaping it, and so on and so forth. That's all true. Those are obviously real obstacles to making a revolution, which anybody who's serious about this has to take into account and figure out how you're going to overcome that. On the other hand, let's look at the other side of the picture. They have this tremendous machinery of propaganda, public opinion, and yet, in the face of this moved to go to war with Iraq, they had one of the most massive outpourings of opposition. Even though the media and the whole machinery of propaganda was mobilized behind this war and became, you know, cheerleaders and apologists for it and everything else. So clearly what you have there exhibited very sharply is the contradiction between reality and the distortion, the fundamental distortion of reality this propaganda machine constantly pumps out, became a very acute contradiction. These two things came very sharply into conflict. And a lot of people just saw through a lot of the propaganda, not all of it, and obviously not all the people, but literally tens of millions of people, and millions of them felt so incensed by what was happening that they felt the need to get into the streets or in other ways express themselves in opposition to it, despite this tremendous propaganda machinery and despite all the power that they have. That was largely, though, not only among the middle class. I mean, we did work and others did work among high school students, a lot of these, you know, proletarian high schools, and hundreds of students were coming out there as well as in more middle class areas. And, you know, this was a tremendous mass outpouring. So that's one thing, where, you know, where you can see that things do break through this grip they have on everything. And then, you know, you have things like what happened in L.A. in 92 or Cincinnati or even places like Benton Harbor, Michigan, that, yes, people are trying to get, you know, they're trying to get paid. They're trying to get the money. You know, that's the culture. I mean, it's pumped at them all the time. I mean, any kind of popular culture that comes forth that calls for something different than that and that challenges that gets marginalized to the degree they can. And, you know, sometimes it breaks through, you know, but then they try to marginalize and they just pump at people constantly, this kind of a culture. You see it in the hip-hop culture now where that's, you know, that whole influence has become dominant because that's what gets promoted and that's where you can get paid, quote-unquote. You're not going to get paid talking about revolution. But you still see those voices, a lot of them now in spoken word, and some of them are in rap, you know, and they're fighting, even though they're not, you know, they're not predominating because of who does control this and what their interests are and what they want out there. But you do see that despite all that, the oppression is there. Mao's point about where there's oppression, there will be resistance is borne out over and over again. And people, you know, get these explosions where thousands or even millions of people, or tens of thousands in any case, or hundreds of thousands, go into motion. Yes, you know, it's short-lived, it spends itself, but it shows the potential that people, and the fact that people want another life. And that a lot of the stuff that people get caught up in is real, yes, I won't say it's not real, but it's also superficial in another way. It isn't really where they live and where they feel. And I know this not just from abstraction, but from the work that we do among these masses with our, you know, with our party all the time, that very sharply contradictory. And interestingly enough, everyone who comes forward in response to our political work and says, you know, starts gravitating toward revolution and toward communism will say, well, I can get into this, but all the rest of the people out here are not going to go for this. Every one of them who comes forward says this, and yet their people keep coming forward, you know. So right there you're seeing the contradiction being given expression, that there are all these pulls on other people, yet people do gravitate toward this, not automatically or without a lot of work and struggle, but they do gravitate toward it because they really hate the life that they're living. And, you know, let's face it, here's this glaring contradiction. People are in the ghetto and they're in the barrio, or they're working in these poor, you know, these poorly paying jobs, you know, in the restaurants and hotels, and not just black and Latinos, but a lot of white people too. And they have all these illusions because it's pumped at them that what they ought to be doing is getting rich, but they're the farthest thing from rich. And most of them are always going to be the farthest thing from rich. And instead, they're brutally exploited when they can even work. And they're oppressed in a thousand ways and, you know, degraded and humiliated in a society. And this bursts forth. So, yeah, people are into all the things that you're talking about. On the other hand, there is a fundamental reality to their lives that continually asserts itself, even through all that. And that's where a vanguard force, a revolutionary party, comes in to work with people to bring that aspect of things forward and to struggle against the other thing and to enable people to see a way out of this. Because as long as you don't see a way out of it, you're going to fall back into all this other stuff. You try to get what you can get. Or, you know, make your way in the world some way and try to, you know, let everybody know you're there in some form or other, which is a lot of what this stuff is about that goes on the street.
Well, before we get into the question of the vanguard, because that is something I wanted to get into, but there's also, I mean, you talk some about the basic people, about the proletarians, but what about, like, in terms of the middle classes, too? I mean, there's a thing there where, you know, I mean, a lot of these people actually are satisfied with their life. I've had the experience where some people have told me, look, even when they begin to know stuff, at one point they said, look, I know some things. I know some things about how the world works. And yet I still live my life. I do what I do, and I find that what I know sometimes I feel is almost like a curse on me because it's got me tied up in that. How, what would you say to that?
Well, there's the life, again, that people want to lead and even to a significant degree are able to lead a lot of the time. And then there's the reality, once again, and what the system is about and what it drags them into, whether they want to or not. You know, I remember a story someone told me about during the build-up to the Iraq War. And they were in some sort of aerobics class with someone, and this one of the kind of people you're talking about, and they, you know, this person was expressing great anger. They said, look, we select these politicians to take care of all this stuff for us, you know, so they should be doing something to stop Bush from going to this war, especially the Democrats. But then this person finds themselves, same person, finds themselves out demonstrating because the Democrats are not doing anything to stop this war. And at a certain point, they really feel that something has to be done because they can see that this is, first of all, this war is terrible in itself. And second of all, it's part of a whole larger thing going on that's not going to be the end of it. And if you let that go on, then other things are just going to keep going in the same direction. It's going to go from bad to worse. So, yeah, a lot of people can, you know, in this society, especially given this role and its position in the world and the fact that it can, you know, plunder and accumulate wealth from the suffering of people all over the world, yes, there are broad strata here who can live relatively well viewed in more narrow terms, in other words, just purely economic terms or even in terms of the culture they have access to and things like that. But there's this reality of this system that keeps doing these things, and there's a reason why people went into the streets against the Iraq War. It wasn't some sort of, you know, arbitrary thing or some incidental or trivial thing that just got up one day on a whim and decided to go oppose what the government's doing. You know, it's because these things do impact people in a lot of different ways, even right now when there's not a draft. You know, and it's still, I think it's becoming an open question whether they're going to reinstitute a draft. But even if they don't, or even now when they haven't, it still impacts people in a lot of ways. And people also can feel that there's something going on in the society where a lot of the assumptions they've had about how the society works with a constitution and elections and you vote and you select the leaders and the one who gets the votes gets to take office and all that sort of stuff and you get to speak your mind or at least your door doesn't get kicked in if you're grumbling about the government and the privacy of your home. But some of these things are starting to come into question now because this whole, what we call this juggernaut, this rolling monster of war and repression that they're carrying out, and what they're setting loose by doing that, and yes, a lot of crazy, you know, religious fanatics out there, not just in the White House, which is a real thing, but also out there, you know, in the world, you know, who have their own ideas about which God ought to be the one that is proclaimed and which kind of world we should have. You know, these things do rebound back on this society. They set in motion a whole bunch of stuff that we've only seen the beginning of, I think. And people can sense this. So they can't just sort of like retreat. I mean, I know I can tell you stories beyond what you said. Like someone would tell me about they were at a party one time talking to people there just about, you know, some cases of police brutality. And these were all sort of liberal-minded people. And finally, one of them said, "Listen, I don't want to say that you're lying, but I just don't want to believe you, because if I just exactly what the phenomenon you're talking about. If I believe that, then it's going to make my whole life be uncomfortable. Basically, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to go on living my life." The way I am. Well, you know, for a while you can choose, you know, if you're in a certain position of relative privilege, and I certainly don't write these people off by any means, because you see them out there doing great things too. But if you're in a position of relative privilege, you can do that for a while. But this system is doing what it's doing, and look what it's doing in the world, you know, and people may try to avoid that or make their peace with it, but it keeps impinging on your life in different ways. And, you know, people don't live just isolated unto themselves. They live in a, you know, larger, you know, context of a society and of social relations with people, and they do interact with other strata of people in the society, much as it's a segregated and, you know, and a stratified and hierarchical society and all that stuff. So these things are working in contradiction. All this is not going to automatically radicalize people or make them revolutionaries, but it does create a lot of turmoil in the society and people's thinking. And that's where, once again, the people who have a revolutionary understanding, you know, a communist understanding, come in terms of working with that, carrying out what we call a process of unity struggle, unity with people, uniting with them where they do see the need to oppose things that the system is doing, and struggling with them about where this all needs to go, and is there a better way that society and the world could be, and what's necessary to get there, and all those questions.
You're listening to an interview with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This interview was done a number of years back, but speaks to some of the critical questions that are still posed in the world today very sharply.
You know, it's interesting. One of the first things I did on the radio was it was called "If I Ruled the World."
But
it was the Nas song. But then I went around on the projects and I asked people what the world would look like. What would they do if they ran the world? And then I went out in a park in Watts and I found a homeless guy and I asked him what he would do, what the world would look like if he ruled it. And then went up and talked to some immigrants and then went to the West Side, talked to some people that worked in law offices, talked to doctors. And, you know, the thing that was really interesting is that one thing, I think it kind of blew a lot of people away to hear the people that lived on the very bottom of society, this guy who was literally picking cans and bottles out of a trash can, stop and take his time and say, look, what I would do is I would make sure that everybody could eat, because I've noticed that there's a lot of very hungry people in the world, you know. And, you know, people, the sort of the broadness and largeness of mind among the proletariat, I think actually really blew a lot of people away. But also the thing that really got me is that I noticed that so many people, including, you know, there was a commonality that existed between both the middle class people and the proletarians. Of no one said, I want to live large, I want to get for me. No one said, if I ruled the world, I'd make sure I'd be living in a mansion, I'd be driving this, or I'd be doing this or doing this. Everyone spoke outwardly about, like, you know, that they would take care of other people. There was a really good sentiment there that sort of, I think, shocked a lot of people when they heard that.
You know, I mean, that's because people do live in a society, you know, even with all the individualism, I'm sure you could find people who'd say that, you know, like, yeah, I just want to get mine. But even a lot of those people would have more to say if you pursued it more deeply. But people do live in a society, and they have some sense of that, however much that's obscured and distorted, how society really works and what's at the foundation of it and what are the real dynamics of it. They still have some sense of that, you know, and that there is that socialization process in that positive sense.
They have a largeness of mind, too, that goes around this thing in a certain sense. I mean, not all of them, like you're saying. It was interesting because it was so compelling because it was sort of, again, there was a basic thing there where people could step up out of themselves and see this thing.
Yeah, and I think especially one of the key elements is you pose this question to people this way, which rarely happens. Most people don't even think that they should be thinking about things like that or that they have anything to say about that. And when it's posed to them in that way, then you get something different than what you might expect. And I think that's the point you're making, or than what a lot of people would expect to hear. And, you know, I don't think you did it like Candid Camera, where they filmed 40 people and then found the one that was good.
Right.
I think, you probably gave an accurate representation. Yeah. Although, you know, you could find people putting forward those other things. But I think the thing you're talking about is very real and does reflect something very real. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing about the people in the middle class. And I know this from my own experience, but not just my personal experience, but the broader experience of the 60s. As a revolutionary force does increasingly come from the base of society, that's going to change the terms of things also in a positive way. When it's a real revolutionary force that's guided by a far-seeing outlook on the whole world and a driving force that wants to not just, you know, change a few things around or put themselves in place of the other people who are messing over everybody else, but actually wants to uproot and eliminate exploitation and oppression altogether, and not just here but all over the world. When you begin to get a force that begins to assert itself on the political stage, so to speak, coming from there, that has a big impact on the rest of society. We've seen that in the 60s, and we will see it again. And it poses the questions differently. For example, right now we have this whole thing about the elections. Anything is better than Bush. You know, yeah, yes, Kerry's no good, but Bush, we got to, you know. And those are the only terms that a lot of people, especially in the middle class, but not only there, can see. They can't see beyond that framework. As increasingly there is this force that's coming from the base that presents a whole different alternative to that, a much more radical one, a much more fundamental, the drive for a much more fundamental change, that's also going to impact the thinking of a lot of people who right now can't see any other alternative. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, I agree with you, Kerry's no good on this, yes, he's just trying to be a better commander-in-chief than Bush, but what are we going to do? You know, people, you know, what are we going to do? And they don't see any other way other than hoping that somebody who's, you know, in the present setup has some access to power could maybe be prevailed on to do something decent or at least not so terrible. But when you begin to get a movement that's among broad strata in society that challenges all that, challenges that whole framework, and as it begins to increasingly get this element of people coming from the base of society who say, we want a whole different world, that will have a big impact also. Not it won't automatically, once again, make everybody fall in line with that or say, yeah, let's go that way, but it's going to raise different questions and present a different way of looking at the options that there are, a different way of looking at what are we going to do.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian 4 or 5 years ago about whether it was crazy or not to try to have a popular revolution in a country like this.
Now, that's a discussion I got into with somebody, actually, right after the other discussion. Later that night, someone who said, well, yes, okay, I can see what you're saying, generally, but here's the problem. I've known you guys for 30 years, and as far as taking out communism, taking out a communist project to people, communist beliefs, you know, and he says that we've always talked about galvanizing a section of people around that, and he says, and for 30 years, he looked at it the other day, and he was thinking, well, where is it? Where are the masses around this project? And for him, I mean, and this leads to, I think it leads to, in both cases, it led to different assessments of where, how you would go about making change. Like in the first case, when the guy was talking about it can't be a popular revolution because everybody's into the bling bling, he took a sort of spook, sat by the door approach to things and thought that 12 people should seize the key levers of power in the society and then change things. And this guy took a different approach. He said, you can't, you know, you haven't, I have yet to see people united around this project, or a significant hunk of people who have stepped out and united around this project. And so I think that really what you have to do is you have to look for coalitions where you can make small dents. And as you gather more and more people up and you each are making your individual small dents, eventually you'll make one huge dent and knock things over. What would you say to that?
Well, there's a lot of questions bound up in that. I mean, going back to the 12 people conspiracy or whatever, the problem with that is, A, you couldn't do it. You're not going to be able to get wrench power with 12 people away from the people who have it now. They have a lot more than 12 people, and they have a lot going for them. And second of all, even if you could, you couldn't do anything different with it than what they're doing. If you don't uproot the whole foundation of this, even if somehow you could magically find yourself in power, you would just have to do the same thing with the same system as what's being done by the people who run it now. And if you didn't have masses of people who were consciously striving for something else, you wouldn't even have any choice, even if you had the best intentions in the world, but to fall back on doing things the way they're done now. I mean, why that's so is a big, you know, long discussion, but I'm firmly convinced it's so, and there's a lot of experience that shows that it is so, where people get in and try to do good things and end up doing the same thing, and that's where you get a lot of this, oh, you know, leaders always sell out, because there is some, just like I said, just literal selling out. But usually it's not that. Usually it's people who have good intentions, but they don't really, their understanding is not profound enough and not comprehensive enough to know that you cannot just, you know, come in from the top and make some changes just because you have good intentions, or you have the interests of the poor at heart, or you have a desire for justice and so on and so forth, which many people, you know, out here do. People who, you know, try to reform the system in various ways, or to act as a force to bring pressure on the powers that be to get them to make some concessions in the direction of justice and, you know, alleviating the poverty and suffering of people and things like that. So that's, you know, that's what's wrong with that approach. It isn't an approach that could, A, actually lead you to get power. And if you did get it, you couldn't do anything good with it. That's the problem with that. Now, as far as the idea that, you know, people won't come forward around this or haven't come forward around this, I think that the problem with that is it's a little bit of a linear view. It isn't, we haven't just been 30 years plugging away on the same, you know, exact continuum. There have been a lot of changes in the world. There was a whole upsurge, not just in this country, but in the world as a whole, going on in the 60s, a whole wave of anti-colonial struggles, you know, and the continuation of them, like in Vietnam, which was a, you know, monumental struggle that led to a defeat of U.S. imperialism and had major repercussions through the whole world. You had the China as a socialist country, which is carrying out a cultural revolution and, you know, figuring out how to keep the revolution from being reversed and make further transformations toward an eventual communist world. And that was, you know, a tremendous inspiration as well as a powerful force in the world itself. And, in you know, in this country, you had great changes that were being set loose by things that were rooted in economic and social changes, like things going on in the South with agriculture and a lot of black people being expelled off the land rather than being almost literally chained to it with debt and the KKK and all the rest of it. You know, and then the Sputnik thing happened, and all of a sudden they wanted more people studying in the schools so the Soviet Union wouldn't be the only ones with satellites. A lot of people came into the universities that were, you know, that wouldn't have been able to get in a generation before. And all these kind of things gave rise to, in combination and interaction with each other, gave rise to a very radical, eventually to a very broadly based radical movement with a lot of people turning toward revolution and Marxism, communism, and so on and so forth, and Mao and all that sort of stuff. So that was a whole period that carried over, you know, the effects of that carried over really to the late 70s. But then, you know, the U.S. regrouped from its loss in Vietnam. It began to more directly confront the Soviet Union, which was also trying to seize on the advantages of the U.S. setbacks in the world. The Soviet Union itself had for a while been turned into a what we call a social imperialist country. It was still socialist in words before Gorbachev got there, and then they eventually ended up dropping all the, even the facade. It was still socialist in words, but imperialist in essence and its inner essence and its role in the world. And things were shifting in a big way. And then, you know, there was a loss of China as a socialist country. The Cultural Revolution was defeated, and then socialism was reversed in China. And this had a tremendous impact throughout the world, including in the U.S., and things were changing inside the U.S. It wasn't this, now you had say among black people, it wasn't the generation that was cut loose and hurled from the land into the urban ghettos, or one or two generations. Now you had people who were living there for a while a lot of the industry was being pulled out, and there was a more polarization because concessions were made, more middle class positions were opened up for black people, but a lot of them moved out of the ghettos. And you had all these profound changes. Then you had a lot more immigrants coming into the country. So it isn't like we've been on, many other changes that we could discuss. It isn't like we've been on one continuum hammering away, trying to get somewhere and never getting anywhere. You know, there was a tremendous movement that came forth out of the 60s. It's what gave rise to our party, not just what was happening here, but the whole international dimension I was referring to. But then we had real setbacks. When you have real setbacks, like the loss of China, and you have shifting tectonic plates almost in the world where the contradictions are playing themselves out in a dramatically different way with the, for example, in the 80s, the U.S. and the Soviet Union staring eyeball to eyeball sort of, and the danger of nuclear war growing, and some of these other anti-colonial struggles in the third world had sort of been reshaped within sort of the terms of this U.S.-Soviet confrontation. This has an effect on people. And we really, I've referred to these, since you're taping for broadcast, I won't use the exact words I use, but I refer to the 80s and 90s as these terrible beep decades, So I'll do it for you.
Thank you.
and we're regrouping from that. And there's been a whole ideological offensive that's gone on in the world and in this country to say that communism is not just discredited, but is a disaster and leads to the horrors of totalitarian tyranny and all the rest of that. Even, somebody was telling me they were listening to some program on the radio, I don't know if it was NPR or what, and somebody was on there talking about how in China under Mao, the standard of living and life expectancy of the Chinese people went way down, which is the exact opposite of the truth. But the point the person who was telling the story was making was you can get up and say any old slander about, socialism now, the experience. I mean, that's exactly the opposite of the truth. The life expectancy in China during the time that Mao was leading China, went from 29 years to 65 years in a space of a couple of decades. And it's unprecedented, positive change. But people come and get on and just say the exact opposite of the truth, and nobody challenges it. So this obviously has its effect ideologically. And then if you look in the world, I know I'm going on about this, but it's a big question, because I think it deserves a serious answer. I mean, I don't want to just dismiss this question. I think it's a very real, important question. But we've had things go on in the world where there's been a conscious effort. Well, there have been two things going on. One, economic changes in a lot of the third world, for example, as well as economic changes within the U.S., but dramatically in the third world, where tens of millions of peasants have been driven off the land by the workings of, increased capitalist globalization, imperialist globalization. They can't even eke out a meager existence under oppressive conditions in the countryside, and they're hurled into the shanty towns around the cities in third world country from one part of the globe to another. And now we've gotten to the point where half the world's population is, or we're approaching the point, we'll soon be at it if we're not at it, where half the world's population lives in these urban areas. Well, this is a profound change from the time, say, they made the revolution in China, where in that country and in most of the third world, 80-90% of the people lived as peasants, exploited as peasants in the countryside. This presents new challenges to us, and the effect of this, where they're neither peasants in the old society, nor are they becoming integrated in the way, say, even with all the horrors of it that happened in England, centuries ago when they built up to the Industrial Revolution, where people became proletarians, and some of them were employed, but many of them were actually became proletarians, employed and exploited and capitalist manufacturing and industry as it developed, and there's, you know, the certain outlook that goes along with that. What's happening in these third world countries is not that. It's that people are, you know, working in the informal economy, if they're working at all. You know, either illegal activity or often, you know, just selling things like, literally, like gum or similar items on the street or finding some way to eke out an existence. And a lot of this has left that, you know, their existence is precarious and they've been uprooted from their traditional situation but not integrated into a really a proletarian situation. This leaves them vulnerable to things like a lot of religious fundamentalism, which is a big phenomenon in the, obviously we know about it in the Middle East, in a lot of countries in that whole arc, including places like Indonesia. But also in Latin America, for example, there's a tremendous growth of Pentecostal fundamentalism.
Mexico, and it was in Chiapas.
Yeah, you know, and it's all over Latin America because the you know, people are seeking an alternative to the Catholic Church, somewhat the way in which a number of black people here reject Christianity but take up Islam. They haven't really made a thorough radical rupture with all that. And the condition of these people who are uprooted from the, you know, in their tens of millions in the third world and hurled into the shanty towns tends spontaneously and in the short run, in a more narrow sense, to make them gravitate towards some of this religious fundamentalism, even though it offers no way out for them. And actually this leads to, you know, worse problems. So these are some of the economic factors. Then there's been, as I started to refer to, a whole conscious political strategy on the part of the imperialists going back several decades to wipe out secular and particularly communist opposition. Indonesia, once again, being the extreme example, where in the mid-60s they had a coup that brought Suharto was in power, who remained in power for several decades, and they just wiped out one of the largest communist party, third largest communist party in the world, which, you know, was sort of ripe for that because it was trying to pursue a strategy of somehow peacefully maneuvering its way into socialism. And they got wiped out by this coup that the CIA worked with Suharto to carry out. Ugh, from between a half a million to a million people were slaughtered in a, you know, short period of time, with the rivers around Jakarta being clogged with the bodies of the people murdered by the military, with the CIA in there directing it ultimately. And you can go to other places where, you know, the Middle East, you know, Nasser, you know, who not a communist, but he was a more secular ruler, and he was very popular, had a lot of influence. But when he was defeated by Israel with the U.S. imperialists behind him in the 60s, then, you know, some of his, you know, prestige went down. And, you know, you could just go from country to country where the secular opposition has been crushed. And, in fact, you know, these religious fundamentalists have been built up by the imperialists. I mean, Afghanistan, we all know, is an example of that, where they, you know, they mobilized, organized, and armed and trained these fundamentalist forces to fight the Soviets in the 80s. But that's not the only place. They've also done the same thing in Palestine. You know, they've moved to undermine the secular forces. Even the Christians, they've driven a lot of Christians out of Palestine, because the Christians in the particular area of Palestine tend to be more secular than a lot of the Islamic forces. And Israel's even worked to build up some of these Islamic fundamentalist forces in opposition to more secular forces. So if you look at all this in the world, and you know, then there are the particular areas of the U.S., some of which I touched on, it's not surprising that we've suffered a lot of setbacks. And really what we're doing is rebounding from that. And this is a time when we're finding that a lot of people, for all the reasons we've been touching on, are very open to big questions and are themselves wrestling with big questions about the whole direction of the world, what kind of world they want to live in. There's that whole slogan that came out of the anti-capitalist globalization movement of another world is possible. A lot of people are wrestling with that, and we're finding a lot more, you know, there's still a lot to overcome, but, you know, we're finding the more we go out boldly with communism, there are a lot more people ready to engage that. I won't say they're all jumping to embrace it, but a lot more people ready to engage that. So I see this is more a matter of a wave-like or spiral-like development that we've been through over the last several decades, and not a linear thing where we've been hammering our head, you know, and just can't get anywhere. We've been thrown back, and now we're rebounding from that, and there's a real challenge to wrench something positive out of these, you know, already acute and you know, likely to become much more acute conditions that this whole juggernaut and the whole development of where the imperialist system is going is throwing the world into.
All right. We've been listening to an interview I did about 4 or 5 years ago with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it was a really broad interview, a really wide-ranging, sweeping, really insightful, and really interesting interview that covered a lot of the critical questions people who dream of having another world need to get into. You know, and the excerpt we heard today was actually dealing with the question of, so you want to have a popular revolution in this country. You think it's possible. Are you nuts? Well, there was another question that comes up all the time. So probably just secondary to that, or maybe even with that. And that is, people will say, all right, you want to have a popular revolution. Well, you're talking about dealing with the most powerful military monster in the history of humanity. You're also talking about dealing with a system that is one of the most ruthless regimes in the history of humanity. So do you really think that it's possible to go up against that? And I posed that question to Avakian as well. And I think in the future, maybe in the next couple of weeks, we'll play the excerpt from that, because I'm sure that that is still a question that a lot of people have when they're listening to this show or when they listen to this segment. And actually, if you have any comments on all these, or you have your own questions you'd like to get into in the course of this show, please let me know, all right? I really look forward to hearing from you about that. Okay, well, that wraps up another show. I want to thank my guests, and I want to thank Age for his production assistance, and all of you for tuning in. And like I said in the beginning, I think that the ideas and challenges posed in these interviews that I ran today remain extremely relevant for today. We live in a world that day by day cries out for radical change, and yet so many either refuse to see it or refuse to do anything about it. This show is dedicated to transforming that, to helping to bring into being a world worthy of human beings. But I also understand deeply that it all depends on us. What we get depends on us and what we do. So hopefully this show makes its contribution each week to that happening. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a classic from Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, a classic that really fits the tone of this entire show. Wake up, everybody.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new